Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
It's Friday, the 29th of November.
So Donica's done a runner away to watch Munster. It's David Gillick here, and coming up today, could Pochettino land the Arsenal job?
I don't know how a guy who's been manager of Tottenham for 5 years really does that, you know, because the first time things go wrong, that's going to be the first thing people think of.
Dunica catches up with old teammate and now World Cup winner Felix Jones.
One of the key things I've realised is that there's 10 different ways of doing things, or more. You can do it whatever way you want, and all of them are right in different departments, but you just have to make sure that you can get 15 or 30 or your squad of 40 people all going in that one direction.
And we have Athlete of the Year Ciara McGeen on her love of cross country.
I've always enjoyed racing cross country. It's actually where I cut my teeth as a youngster and began athletics, and as much as I'm not the world's leader over cross, I think it serves a very good purpose for me over the winters.
All that and much, much more between now and 8 o'clock. Text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Today is Friday, so that means that we have our Punters Council. So if anybody wants to win some money for their nominated club or charity, text their name to 51552. David Gillick, you're very welcome to Game On.
Thanks for having me in, super sub.
We're thrilled to have you in. Donica's off gallivanting at rugby matches again. He's starting to make a habit of that.
It's a true love, Maria. You got to accept that, you know.
Yeah, trying to separate him from Munster rugby is absolutely impossible. So I'm not even going to try. A bit like you with athletics. It's hard to get away from it when you're so involved in it, isn't it?
Yeah. I suppose with me, it was, it's part of my DNA. And you're always drawn back to it, you know. You're always following it. And even... I suppose it's a sport, like many sports, it just keeps giving. Just plenty of headlines.
And any time there is a headline, it gets thrown at you. So we have one today. Mo Farah is to return to track at the Tokyo Olympics.
Yeah.
He is going to run the 10,000 metres. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this has been around for a while. Like even this year with the Worlds in Doha, there was rumours, would he... you know, participate, would he do the 10k? Even though after London 2 years ago he said, you know what, I'm going onto the road, I want to be a marathon runner, and try and execute that. I suppose when you do look at the last couple of years over the marathon, he did set a European record back in 2018 winning Chicago, that was a 2:05, but then he hasn't really kind of backed that up. And even this year in Chicago again, he was way down, he was 10th. And yeah, he's just come out today and said, you know what, I want to go back on the track, I want to add to the medals that he's won in the Olympics, and he wants to give Tokyo a crack, which is going to be really, really interesting. You know, I think with everything about the headlines around him, who he has associated himself with over the last couple of years, he's putting himself under the spotlight again. In terms of on the track, I think when you look at Farah's career, it's that last lap, it's that pace, that speed that he has. Like, he's able to finish off a 10K, 25 laps, his last lap. You know, he's banging out a 55 or 50, even quicker 54s in the past over his last lap, which is phenomenal times. That's his asset. Now, he's switched to the marathon. He's obviously increased his mileage. Has he lost that speed? Does he still have it? We don't know. So what I think he'll do next year is he'll completely and utterly ditch the marathon and he'll solely focus. He'll completely change his training and he'll focus back on the 5 to 10K. He said he's not going to double up, so he's not doing the 5K. He does have to run the qualification time, which he's well capable of. That's 27:28. Now, he's 45 seconds quicker than that, and he has to do that before the 21st of June. So he's plenty of time. It will be very interesting if he can get back to the level that he was at, particularly that speed, because that's the difference between Mo Farah and some of the other athletes. Now, when you do look at Doha, you had people like Kipruto, Kjelka, all these kind of guys, Cheptegei, who won at the Ugandan, like they're fairly quick guys and they're young guys as well. So it'll be very interesting, you know, how the kind of next couple of months and when will we get the first insight into what he's doing.
So I know you're not an athlete anymore, but you're still very immersed in athletics and you've got a lot of friends who are in athletics as well. Do people want Mo Farah at the big events, at the big games? Do your fellow athletes, the people that you know, a lot of the people involved in the sport, is he still welcome there?
I don't know whether it's a case of kind of welcome or not. I think the issue is that Mo Farah now has just too many questions around him and he hasn't answered them. He hasn't answered anything to do with like his career in terms of Salazar, who he's been associated with, even going as far as Gemma Adan, the agent over in Ethiopia. And all these people have a really, really bad reputation. And I think even when you look at what's recently happened with Salazar and all the other athletes coming out, Farah hasn't really answered those questions. Like, he was peppered with questions prior to the Chicago Marathon and he was awful. Like, he was brutal in terms of even, you know, answering them. And I don't think he's been honest. I think there's a lot of questions there. And I think from that perspective, I think when people see, okay, Mo Farah, headlines again, Tokyo. And look, I'll be honest, I've looked at some of the British media and they're lapping it up. They're loving it. You know, a lot of people are all over. It's great. Our best Olympian is coming back onto the track. He's going to add medals. And they're already talking about the fact that, oh, he'll get on the podium. And I think that's disappointing because he hasn't answered the questions and there's a lot of ifs and buts. And you know, I think when you refer to people within the sport, myself, friends, yeah, we've all got these questions. And I think, to be brutally honest, yeah, I don't really kind of welcome him back. I think, you know what, mate, you're better off out in the road there because you're putting yourself a lot under the spotlight again. It kind of reminds me of Armstrong, you know. It's not good. He's making a comeback and you kind of think, you know, is he sailing very close to the wind this time and maybe he'll be caught out.
Just one final question on it and I'll keep it brief. UK Athletics commissioned an independent review into its dealings with Alberto Salazar and his Nike Oregon project. Do you think they need to take it a step further and maybe launch an investigation into Mo Farah because he was working with him from 2011 to 2017?
Of course they do. Yeah. And I think with the week that they've had, if you look at UK Athletics, the new CEO's had to resign even before she took up the post because of, you know, issues going on with kind of club level and allowing people who had previous backgrounds with kids and stuff to coach shouldn't have happened. She's had to step down. And definitely when you look at the investigation that they did prior to or when the issue first arose a couple of years ago, when they investigated, oh, you know, Farah's gone out with Salazar, it was a couple of phone calls, apparently. And that was it. And I think, you know what, if they need to save face here, they need to work hard, they need to get back in there and actually find some real, real key answers to what was going on.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll happen though. But anyway, moving on to more headlines because Arsenal have been dominating them today. Unai Emery, the man who followed two decades of Arsene Wenger, couldn't last two seasons. He was sacked today by the club and we spoke to Andrew Mangan of Arsblog about the situation. I started by asking him why this happened.
Very simply, results and performances have been subpar for too long, basically. This season hasn't been great. It's 4 wins from 13 in the Premier League. And last season, Arsenal blew a very big chance to get into the Champions League and also lost in a European final. And what we've seen this season is pretty much a continuation of the end of last season, despite the fact the club went out and spent quite a lot of money in the transfer market. So ultimately, it boils down to bad results, bad performances, and a manager who appears to have lost the dressing room and been unable to turn things around.
There's always a straw that breaks the camel's back. What was it, do you think, in this case?
I think it's been death by a thousand cuts in many ways. I'm not sure there's been one particular incident. Certainly the end of last season, as I mentioned, was a black mark. The Watford game earlier in this season when Arsenal were 2-0 up and then fell apart in the second half. Watford had 30-odd attempts on goal. That really damaged things. I think that was a performance that had profound effect on the team, the players, their belief in the coach, and also the fans and their belief in the coach. But there's been so many other bits and pieces going on. Mesut Ozil been left out in the cold this season and last season. The Aaron Ramsey situation, Lauren Koscielny looking to get away during the summer, the Granit Xhaka situation, which happened a few weeks ago. You know, there have been countless issues on and off the pitch, which I think have got us to the point where the Arsenal hierarchy have at last decided that this is no longer a situation that they can tolerate. And they've done something which hopefully will help them have a chance at least of salvaging the season.
Andrew, just in terms of, I suppose when moments like this happen, it's very much focused on the manager. You know, as a fan, as a supporter, what about the players? Do the players have any responsibility in this?
Yeah, I think they do, of course. But one of the big issues that we've seen since Unai Emery took over is a a variation in performances, which is also tied into a manager who changes his formation week in, week out. He changes his tactics. He changes his system. He doesn't just do it game on game. He does it within the game as well. Quite often he has made two changes at halftime, you know, change from a back four to a back three, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's been a lack of continuity. And over the course of his time at Arsenal, Unai Emery never really put in place a footballing philosophy, or at least a platform from which to use these tactical switches. So there was no one defined style of play, which was the baseline from which they could then pivot to different systems, et cetera, as they needed to. And I think, yeah, you can look at the players, but I think it comes down to them simply not really understanding what he wanted them to do week by week. And as time has gone on, their performances individually and collectively have declined. And I don't think you can really put it all on the players in that sense. If it was just one or two players who weren't playing well, then maybe. But really, there haven't been, apart from maybe Aubameyang this season, there hasn't been anyone who's stood out or played to their potential. And that, to me, that comes back to the manager.
9 different captains during his time there. Was there a lack of natural leaders, or was it the fact that he didn't empower them?
That's a good question. I think it's quite a bit more the latter than the former. You know, Granit Xhaka has been someone who was criticised for what's gone on recently, but you know, he is actually a natural captain. Whether people like him as a player or not, that's a different thing. But he was the captain at Borussia Mönchengladbach. He's the captain of Switzerland. And when Lauren Koscielny kicked up this summer and left to go back to France, he should have been made captain straight away because he was the obvious candidate. Instead, Unai Emery took over 2 months to make a decision on that. And by the time he made the decision, Xhaka was frustrating people with what he was doing on the pitch. And it led in no small part to that outburst that we saw against Crystal Palace. And I think as well, you know, the idea of a leadership group, this 5 captains, you know, it makes sense on some level, I guess, but it's not difficult. It's one of the least difficult things that a manager has to do is pick his captain. And he made a complete procession of it. So I do think that there were leaders there, but it's been diluted by Emery's indecision.
In terms of the money spent, did he buy well? Did he waste the money? Or was that his responsibility? Or was there someone else involved?
The way that the club is set up now, it's this structure where the club buys the players and the head coach, you know, he's given the job of working with those players. Whereas previously under Arsene Wenger, he was the guy who gave the green light for any transfer in and out. And so in this new structure, Emery certainly would have had some input into the kind of players that Arsenal brought in. But, you know, we knew he wanted a winger and they got him £72 million Nicolas Pepe, you know, the hottest wide talent in Europe. And he's been unable to find a way to get anything close to the best out of him. They got him a left back. They got him a central midfielder. They got him a central defender. You know, they got him the players that he wanted or players in the positions that he wanted, but, you know, has been unable to really mold them into a cohesive unit. I mean, I think there is some sympathy for him because he's had injuries to key players to deal with. Kieran Tierney arrived injured. Hector Bellerin, Rob Holding, you know, had big injuries last season. You know, I don't think you can really put the blame, if you like, or put the responsibility of transfers on Emery, but certainly it was his responsibility to get that group of players playing decent football, being strong defensively, and, you know, really Arsenal are worse off now when he's leaving than they were when he took over, and things weren't great when Arsene Wenger left.
What about the interim manager, Freddie Ljungberg? Were you surprised that it was him? And do you think we could have an Ole Gunnar Solskjaer situation on our hands here?
I'm not surprised it was him because he's the obvious candidate. And in this context and these circumstances, I think it was normal that they've turned to him. He's very highly regarded. He's got a good record coaching the Arsenal under-23s. And he did have a spell as assistant manager of Wolfsburg as well a couple of years ago. So he's not without experience, you know, but obviously hasn't managed at first team level. I don't quite know what's going to happen here, whether if he performs well enough, he'll get the job, or if Arsenal are just putting him there until such time as they can find the right man. But But what he is somebody that people will have some belief in. He's a very popular ex-player, of course, because he was part of, you know, Arsenal's best teams, you know, winning the double, going unbeaten throughout a season. And his core principles appear to be a bit more in line with what Arsenal fans expect Arsenal to be, which is good attacking football. So I think there's a big measure of relief, and with that, some hope and expectation that Freddie can turn things around. The question really is why Arsenal didn't do this before the last international window, when he would have had a couple of weeks to prepare for the Southampton game instead of giving him 2 days to prepare for a game against Norwich.
Who do you expect to be the next full-time manager of Arsenal, Andrew?
I couldn't tell you, to be honest.
Who would you like?
Poch.
No, I don't see that as realistic, to be honest. I don't see how, when Arsenal are a club in need of somebody to provide some unity and togetherness, I don't know how a guy who's been manager of Tottenham for 5.5 years really does that, you know, because the first time things go wrong, that's going to be the first thing people think of. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Mikel Arteta.
That was Andrew Mangan there of Arsblog talking about what has been going on at Arsenal. Alan, I have to say, I hope that this isn't something that goes on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and we're talking about who could possibly get it and whether Freddie Ljungberg will stay on. Who do you think will get it, and who would you like to get it?
It's hard to know, Marie, but I heard a rumour today, and it was probably more of a rumour when you see the betting odds and the bookmakers slashing odds, and Allegri was actually mentioned and his odds were slashed this morning, and I think he's exactly what Arsenal need, because the reason I'm most disappointed with Emery, and normally when a manager gets sacked you have some sort of sympathy for them, I've absolutely zero sympathy for Emery, because the players are a shambles, but he's been picking them every week, mistake after mistake. You look at him signing David Luiz at the start of the season, the amount of mistakes he's made since he's come in. He was an embarrassment last week with the defending for the goal against Southampton. You look at Socrates beside him, another one make a mistake after mistake. It was the same last night against Eintracht Frankfurt. You look at the stuff that has gone on with Xhaka playing again last night. So if that's the spine of your team, Luis, Socrates, Xhaka, Ozil, you've no chance as a manager. And the most obvious thing that was sticking out as well when he went in was the issues they had defensively, and those are the issues that he should have addressed straight away, and he hasn't addressed them whatsoever. They played Southampton last week, Southampton coming off the back of a 9-0 defeat a couple of weeks ago against Leicester, down languishing at the bottom of the table. They had 21 attempts at goal against Arsenal last week, so they're just not learning from the mistakes that they're making, and that's basically falls at the door of the manager. I watched him last night against Eintracht Frankfurt, and they were nothing short of a disgrace, the players. And that may sound strong, and the players are a bit of a mishmash anyway. I'd have no faith in a lot of them, but I put the blame solely on the manager, because he's picking them week after week, regardless of the stuff that they're doing.
Alan, I never introduced you there. Alan Cawley, everyone.
Well, I think after that people might know.
But what they're not seeing, and what they're missing out in, is that you're very stylish denim jacket. Well, you've got.
Heading out.
Am I not always stylish?
Hashtag out.
Am I not always stylish? No.
Donal Kelby raging now he missed that denim jacket. Stephen Kelly, former Republic of Ireland international, also joins us on the line. Stephen, Alan was very strong there, very critical of the players. What are your thoughts on the situation at Arsenal?
You kind of have to concur with him. The players have not performed at any level, but the manager is ultimately who the book stops at. And the problems that they had defensively are huge problems that Arsenal have had for such a long time, and he didn't address them at all in the summer. He didn't, like, David Luiz was not the answer. He was a defender who was on his way out in the sense of age and everything. He might have come in and have a half-decent season, but he was never going to galvanise them or be that pivotal person that they can build a team around. Instead, he went down and bought wingers and attacking players, where, to be honest, they've always kind of had those. They've got a goal threat, and with Aubameyang up front, they're in games. They've always got a chance of scoring a goal. They didn't need to strengthen those areas as much as he did. So defensively, not getting the options. I don't know whether that was the board or whether that was the manager, but as a manager and being there for a little while looking at the team, he should have said to them, listen, my priority is getting me in two central defenders that I know I can rely on and are going to be here for next few seasons, and I can mould them into and build a team around them. And he didn't do that. So that it's a big issue, and they haven't addressed it. It has to fall with him. But the players, again, they haven't performed at any way the standards that Arsenal have set over the years. And, you know, it's right that he's gone now.
So what happens next? Right. Okay, Ljungberg's come in. Mm. What does he have to do? They've got Norwich on Sunday. You know, can he plug a gap, or is there something he can straight away do to change things up?
See, the problem with that, David, is he's been part of the environment that's been created there with Emery. Now that he's kind of seen as the manager in charge, even if it's only a short period of time, does he go against everything that maybe if he believes in something different, does he go against everything that Emery's been preaching for the last number of weeks? If he does, I'd be highly critical of him, because if that's the case, why didn't he speak up while Emery was the manager? Maybe he did, maybe he don't. Obviously, it always will come back and the responsibility will lie with the manager. So we don't know what conversations have maybe gone on in the background. But I can envisage seeing much more of the same. Now, the problem there is, as Marie said at the start, the first question was, you don't want this to drag out. And the main issue I have with Emery, as Stephen also outlined, is the defensive issues. When Arsene Wenger was coming near the end of his time, everybody could see that there was a kind of a soft underbelly with Arsenal. It was the most obvious thing everywhere. Everyone could see it in the performances. Everyone used to speak about it. So if you're a manager coming in, the first thing he addresses is your biggest weakness. He never addressed that whatsoever. I was sure at the start of this season, that was the first thing again he would do. He had another opportunity to do it. Never did it. Bringing in Luis, as we all know, is a YouTube kind of footballer. Lovely little clips, love and all that, but you're not going to rely on him to keep goals out, as we've seen even with his Chelsea days. The first thing Frank Lampard done with him, out the door, because he knows he can't rely on him. So I think that's why Allegri is the man to have to get, because if you look at all the teams that he's managed, the brilliant teams that he's managed with Juventus, AC Milan, he comes with that background of the Italian mindset of a defensive, and that's what Arsenal are crying out for, because going forward they're very good. They will create chances. They've two excellent centre forwards, as we know, in Lacazette and Aubameyang, so they have a lot of good things going for them, but it's that soft underbelly that's always been there that hasn't been addressed since Wenger, and hopefully the new manager, if it is Allegri or someone coming in, that's the first thing they have to fix.
Stephen, wall-to-wall coverage today, this, and all the Arsenal former players that are coming out, everyone is saying that they need to rebuild, that there's a massive rebuilding job that needs to be done. Do you think so?
It's hard to say. I don't think it's a quick fix. I don't think someone's going to come in and just add one or two players and they're dramatically going to change how they're performing. I think overall in the club there needs to be a change in philosophy and the way they need to go about things. They need to become... For the last few years, even in the Wenger, as Alan said, they've had a soft underbelly. You always felt like you could get at them. You could, if you got into them, if you're physical with them, you could turn them over. They have to change that. Those Arsenal teams that were the unbeatables that went on, they were physically strong men that went down the pitch and couldn't be bullied and won leagues and were comfortable, but then also had a playing style that was such a joy to watch and horrible to play against, to be perfectly honest. So they have to get back to that sort of level where they're not seen as being a soft touch. They have to be a team that is consistently performing and have a nice spine about them. It's going to be hard. It's not going to be an easy quick fix. And I do think we'll take a while to change. And what they have to do now is get a manager in that they have for a long time and they feel like they can invest in and they can put money into, and that he's going to make the right signings. But it's so hard to know whether that's going to work, because fans just want instant results. They want the change straight away, and that might not happen. This could be a Man United type thing. A manager being at a club for such a long time has such an influence on them, and Wenger had that. So the changeover, I don't think it was ever going to be a quick fix for them. It's like a Man U. It's going to take time to get back to a level of what they were before.
So, Alan, on that note, we're talking about managers going, exiting. Could Ole Gunnar Solskjaer be next?
There's a few in line, Marie. Like, if you were to... I was only thinking of it the other day. Like, Silva's obviously, and some may have thought... I actually thought at the weekend he would have gone before Emery, but then looking at the performance last night, as I said, there was no way he was going to survive that. I thought Silva would have been gone. Pellegrini at West Ham, I think, is under serious pressure as well. Possibly Hasenhüttl at Southampton. So there is, as you say, Solskjaer as well. And the problem with Solskjaer at the moment, Marie, is while Pochettino is still out of a job, and as we saw last week with the world we live in nowadays, for 70 minutes on Twitter, that was all people were talking about. So that's always going to be there when they're kind of, maybe if they're losing or drawing or not playing well, until he gets a job. But I heard you also mentioned about maybe Pochettino coming in at Arsenal. I can't see that happening at all, especially when the likes of Bayern Munich are in the mix, because he's ready to make that step now, I think, to a top quality team that's ready to win trophies. Arsenal would be a major step back for Pochettino.
So would you say Poch wouldn't be interested, you know, if the United job came
I think out? He would be interested in United because of the size and stature of the club. Certainly not Arsenal though, and especially with the link with Spurs. But I think he may be. But if Bayern Munich are on the radar, or maybe one of the top teams in Spain that were mentioned as well, I think he'd go for one of them before maybe the Man United. Yeah. Solskjaer, I think, will stick it out now for another while, even though I don't think he's the man for the job. But Man United just can't keep sacking managers either. And I suppose the fact that they've kind of put their faith in him, they have to be seen to be doing that now, because Man United are becoming just like every other normal club, that they were never, that they're just sacking manager after manager. And I suppose they will have to try and get away from that perception from the outside as well.
Stephen, Liverpool...
Sorry, I was jumping across there. I was saying for Poch, I would think him going to like a Bayern Munich is more of what he would want, because you'd feel that the whole thing about Poch is he hasn't won a trophy. He needs to win a trophy. Mm. It's pretty much ready-made if he goes to Bayern. He doesn't have to do that much to get them to a level of winning a trophy. He's capable of going in there and winning something with them. So then that monkey's off his back and he can move on to bigger and better things, where if he was to go to Man U, it's not guaranteed. There's a lot to change at that club before he could get that.
Liverpool, or Alan mentioned there that United are like any other club, and when you look at Liverpool, they've won as many Premier League games as Arsenal, Man U and Spurs combined, which is
that's
pretty
staggering. Yeah. Like they're in some form. I know they obviously didn't play that well against Napoli the other day, but the performances from Liverpool, and again it goes back to the manager, Marie, like you've top quality players there, but it's the demands he puts on them, and that's the difference with the top boys compared to the ordinary Joes. And the same with Guardiola, you're dealing with world class players, but the demands he puts on them, and as I've often said on the show here, like, don't let Klopp fool you with the kind of smiley, very personable attitude and approach. Behind the scenes, like, there's a real steel about him. And they're obviously playing, you look at the records, I know they're probably not hitting the heights as what they did last year, and especially defensively, because they were watertight defensively, but they're still winning the games and they're on some run at the moment.
Stephen, Everton and Leicester, we mentioned briefly about Marco Silva, and we know about the run of games that he's heading into. It's pretty horrendous. Has he any hope of getting a win against Leicester?
You wouldn't think so with the way Leicester are playing. They're free-flowing. They've got great confidence about them. He has them playing a style and brand of football that's really enjoyable to watch, but they're very hard to stop, because they've got, with Vardy, who just creates great runs, makes great runs off the channels, always off the back of the shoulder, the defenders. He's a nightmare to play against. And when you have someone like Maddison in front of him who's always trying to look forward with the first pass, they make very, very good, exciting team. And, you know, Rodgers has done extremely well to get them to the level they're at now. And you just feel like they're going from strength to strength. So you would say he's got an absolute tough task to try and get a win at that. And then you look into their fixtures over the Christmas period, you kind of feel like it's just, he's on borrowed time, realistically.
They've won their last five on the bounce, Marie, Leicester, and Rodgers doing some job. You asked me who would I like to see to get the job. I think Brendan Rodgers should be managing a top four club. Now, I know they're not probably seen as top four clubs anymore, United and Arsenal, because it's not a given. But certainly, I suppose, throughout the Premier League era, everybody viewed them as the top four. And I think he should be managing in the top four. He's done an unbelievable job. You even look at, they've scored 31 goals defensively as well, which is probably something people wouldn't associate with Brendan Rodgers. But they've only conceded 8 goals. Like, sort of, he's doing an unbelievable job at Leicester. They've won their last five on the bounce. They will beat Everton on Sunday, and I think that's Silva done as well.
And to think that they sold a defender for 80 million as well, and they've still got a fantastic defensive record. Just
yeah, it's unbelievable, yeah.
And Man City, Newcastle?
They'll win. Well, I watched Newcastle the other night again, and like, you're looking at Steve Bruce, and the setup, it just baffles me. You're going to the likes of Aston Villa, who had lost 3 on the bounce. Mm. Obviously under a bit of pressure. Now, they're decent at home, Aston Villa, but they were under a bit of pressure. And he just goes and just sets up so defensively and never takes them on. Then when they fall 2-0 down, having absolutely no attempts on goal whatsoever in the first half, he decides to come out with a different approach in the second half and to start to cause a couple of problems. And you're just thinking, like, you can understand that approach again tomorrow now, playing against Man City or Liverpool or one of the top teams. But when you're going to the likes of a club who've just been promoted, regardless of your own squad or your setup, but you'd like to think Newcastle can go there and maybe set up with an approach that they could take them on in a game. So it just baffles me, the manager. Steve Bruce was desperate the other night against Villa.
And just quickly, Stephen, Chelsea, West Ham?
Yeah, again, another manager under a lot of pressure, and Chelsea who are playing really good football. You know, Lampard has got them again set up in an extremely good manner of, they press high, they've got loads of energy, enthusiasm, they pass the ball well, they're creating loads of chances. He seems to have galvanised the club and got a real big support and a backing behind them. On the other side, West Ham, you know, the players are talking about finishing the top 6 and 4 at the start of the season. I heard quotes from David Noble and I was laughing at it, thinking there's no chance. They're just so inconsistent, and they've been exactly the same this season. Granted, their goalkeeper situation, I think, has been a big thing for them, and he is probably throwing a few goals. So Fabianski, if he was to come back anytime soon, could definitely help them. But they're so hit and miss. You don't know which team is going to turn up on the day, and you just fancy Chelsea to steamroll them, really.
Guys, thanks very much. Isn't it funny? It feels like it was about 6 weeks ago since Mourinho got the job, now that the Emery stuff has happened. But
it just changes. The picture changes daily in the Premier League. It's unbelievable, the stories.
But there's going to be more over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, there's 3 or 4
on the top.
Crazy Flores as well at Watford. Do you think he's probably going to get at some point.
And you look, you look at the job Steve Nuno Espirito Santo is doing at Wolves. Like, he should be in the mix for the likes of the Arsenal job. Even Chris Wilder. Like, why don't Eddie Howe, these type of managers? Like, if Sean Dyche was called Sean Dyshinio, he'd get a job. Like, you know, it's ridiculous, really. Like, you know.
Yeah, it is. It's just based on the fact that they're not as desirable. They're not as desirable because they don't come from a foreign background. They haven't proven themselves as playing this style of football in a foreign country. What Wilder's doing at Sheffield United is remarkable. I have to know, I've seen them play last season in the Championship, and I thought, I think I've said on here before, there's no way they can play that style of football in the Premiership. And lo and behold, they're doing it with players that most people would have said are not good enough to play in the Premiership, but yet they're taking on everybody at their game and playing at their own style, which is just remarkable to watch. I mean, hats off to them. I think it's revolutionary, but because it's Wilder, it's not really deemed as that.
Okay, guys, we could talk about this all night. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back after these. Text 51552. Game on. Weekdays from 6. So the Pro 14 is back and Dunica has exited stage left. He's away watching Munster play tonight. But earlier, he and I previewed the weekend ahead and today's big news for Connacht. Game on.
Rugby. We're delighted to be joined by Brendan Fanning from the Sunday Independent and Grand Slam winning scrum half Tomás O'Leary. Brendan, I'll come to you first. Brilliant news, Bundy Aki signing a 3-year deal with Connacht and the RFU.
Yeah, funny, I got a phone call from a colleague of mine during the week asking me did I know anything about Bundy Aki going to France, and I said no, and he said, oh, that's all to go. They're throwing telephone numbers at him, he'll hardly stay in Connacht. So, huge news for Connacht to keep him there. He's massively important. His form has been really good. He's been their best buy-in at any point. So, that's a terrific start to their weekend.
Tomás, you've travelled. You could see why he would be of interest to French clubs.
Yeah, absolutely. Just the calibre of player he is. And he's illustrated that throughout his time in Connacht and obviously with the Irish team. And I think it's important for Connacht to hold on to these players. You've seen Marmion signing on. Now, obviously, Bundy Aki, you know, it's great for the local area and to keep numbers coming into the ground, and obviously with their big plans to build a stadium there as well. So it's great for Connacht Rugby, and you know, encourages the youth of Connacht that, you know, you can stay there and you can become an international player.
Brendan, out of all the provinces, Connacht are leading the way with getting the work done, signing up players at the moment, aren't they?
They are. I would echo Tomás's comments about the stadium, though, and we were in Leinster there during the week, some of the Sunday hacks, for an interview with Robbie Henshaw. And the moment you walk into Leinster, you just cannot but be impressed by the quality of the headquarters that they're in. Like, it's a fabulous building. They have everything, top of the range gym, loads of pitches, all the support systems. And every time you get down to Connacht, you think, when are they going to get it? Now, they have the plan clearly is signed off on. I don't know what the chronology is on the time scale and how soon they're going to start turning a sod, but it really can't happen fast enough because they need to match off the field what they're doing on the field.
We might turn to the Pro 14 tonight, and Tomás, Ulster at Ravenhill against the Scarlets. They've won 6 of their last 8. They haven't lost in Ravenhill in 14 months and they've been named yet another strong side. How do you see it going?
Yeah, look, I've been impressed with what Ulster are building, to be fair. I suppose we have spoken about them, you know, in regards to the European competition, and I probably dismissed them as contenders. And look, to be fair to them, they've probably proven that, you know, they're a bit ahead of the road than maybe what I thought anyway. And look, at home in this league, like you said, they still have a strong team, made a few changes, but I suppose the core of the team with Cooney there, Herring in a 2. And in the back row, you know, you could see there. So I think they have a strong team and it should have too much for Scarlets away from home. I'd be pretty confident that Ulster should get the home win this week.
Yeah, and Bill Johnson starting at 10. Brendan, would you echo what Tomás is saying there? They look strong at home.
Yeah, I'd say they're unbackable tonight, lads. Not least because 9 Scarlets are involved in this Wales game against the Barbarians, which is just a complete money spinner. It's nothing other than that.
It's Rory Best's 50th goodbye.
The long good, I don't know how much he's getting for the long goodbye, but certainly the Welsh Rugby Union are pocketing more money. It's been a good week for Wales between the CVC money coming from the Pro 14 and the money coming from I don't know if it's going to be a full house or not, but the impact on the Scarlets is massive. They have 7 lads starting for Wales and 2 on the bench. So Ulster will, I'd say Ulster will hack up tonight. And yeah, it will be interesting to see Bill Johnson at 10 because across the across the provinces, not least in Munster, where we've discussed the fitness issues around town. Johnson, of course, is a former son of Munster, so if he was to go to Ulster and make a name for himself, I think it would be really good for business.
Yeah, I think everyone would echo that. It's good to see players like that playing within the country and getting game time. So you both predict an Ulster win on that one. We'll move on to the other game of the night. Munster taking on Edinburgh in Irish Independent Park. And there's a bit to this. There's a bit of a rivalry now, Tomás, with Edinburgh, you know, from playing each other in Europe. This should be an exciting game.
Yeah, it should be, and I suppose Edinburgh have come pretty loaded. A lot of experience coming over, and I suppose it's the opposite of Munster, where conversely, you know, they've changed almost their whole squad from last weekend. So look, it's a fantastic opportunity for the younger and the peripheral Munster players to stake their claim for Champions Cup spot. I suppose Dan Goggin, particularly in midfield, I think he's been unfortunate not to get more games. Obviously, you know, the form of Scannell has been good. Interesting to see Daly at full back. I think he's a fine player, and I suppose the likes of Nash are coming back in the back three as well. In the pack there, I've been very impressed with Witcherly in the second row, even coming on, making an impact in the Champions Cup. And of course, it's a big day for Stephen Archer getting his 200 caps. So look, it's a big challenge for Munster. Look, the likes of Van der Voelt and Pygras at nine will be good controlling games, and they've the likes of Ben Toulis in the pack. So, but look, home advantage hopefully, and a bit of momentum with Munster, I think this young team might be able to nick a win.
Donica, Tomás mentioned Stephen Archer making his 200 club appearance in the Pro 14. Just the 11th Munster man to reach that mark. It's not easy to get there, is it?
No, it's not. And especially in that position, I think he's been an incredible player that's been a little bit unlucky. Maybe picked up an injury at a critical time of his career when he was just breaking into the Irish kind of scene, and kind of kept him out for a little bit of time. But this guy has a work rate like no one really appreciates. He's strong at set piece, of course, like you'd have to be to pick up 200 caps for Munster. But I was always impressed with him. And Brendan, you might explain it a little bit more. But his work rate around the pitch, he's a good man to carry a ball, always makes gain line. And his point of difference for me is his tackle rate and his work rate at breakdown. He gets through a mountain of work, and it's great to see him at home tonight with his family there to run out for his 200 cap.
Donica, his point of difference is that he's from Cork, first and foremost, for yourself and Tomás.
Yeah, he's a Christian's boy too.
I couldn't even get to what school he went to.
Yeah, no, the right one.
I would have enormous respect for anybody who can play, who can get over the 200 mark. Now, he's a couple of caps for Ireland as well, so he's played at least, this will be tonight, 202 first-class games. To survive over 200 games as a tight head prop in a collision sport like rugby is absolutely a savage achievement. He's not even 32 yet. I think he'll be 32 early in the new year. So God knows where he'll stop. But yeah, fair dues to him. Absolutely. It's a terrific achievement. And they will need him tonight, because I was chatting to a Scottish colleague of mine earlier on today, and he looked at the lineups and he said Richard Cockrell would be saying to the Edinburgh lads, if you can't beat this Munster lineup, don't come in for work on Monday morning.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like Richard Cockrell going against Graham Rowntree, and normally we expect a really experienced Munster pack. It's not tonight. If you looked over, you'd nearly say that Edinburgh pack, I would think it's better than the Scottish pack of forwards. You know, just you look at everyone that's coming in there, you know, Stuart McNally, Hamish Watson, and then Mata at eight. I think he was the player of the Pro 14 last year. Outstanding player. Brendan, do you think, Graham Rowntree will be able to get that young pack up and going?
Oh, no doubt. And it's not that young a pack. Like, they're fairly grizzled. McAnally has a bit of personal business as well, given that he was gazumped by Fraser Brown in the World Cup in the Scotland team. So he really needs to get good form and produce it very quickly. Magnus Bradbury is probably one of the best carriers in the competition. Himself, Hamish Watson and Bill Matta in the back row is a serious combination. So yeah, look, that is a huge, huge challenge for Munster. And if they can get away with a win, they would be happy with a draw. Obviously, I would have thought to get away with a win against a team of that quality, given Munster's lack of experience, I think would be a fantastic result for them.
Yeah, and of course, always the key men to push him around the pitch tonight, Nick McCarthy and Ben Healy, Tomás. Young Ben Healy, everyone's been excited for him now for a while around the Munster scene since, you know, Glenn Stoll winning a Senior Cup, him winning the Grand Slam with the Irish under-20s. You know, how do you think he'll go tonight?
Yeah, hugely excited to see him play a professional game. I actually saw him in the Schools Cup final that day, and what struck me about his performance was he just had a lot of time on the ball, obviously physically imposing for a schoolboy at the time as well. He, I don't know what height he is, he must be 6 foot two or three anyway, so he'd almost remind you of Larkin's kind of playing style, kind of languid, relaxed, very skillful player. So look, he has all the, I suppose, attributes to physically step up this level, and from what I've seen thus far, he has the skills in abundance too. So look, it's fantastic to see a young, exciting guy like him get an opportunity. And like you said, it's an interesting selection with McCarthy at nine. Look, I've seen little of him really since he's come down from Leinster. And I suppose coming down his from third choice from Leinster, he's a lot to prove to see whether he can be a genuine contender for the nine jersey in Munster.
So how do you see it going tonight?
Well, I think Munster have a fantastic, like, playing at home, you'd expect Munster to be under pressure, but given the team they've named, the young team, I think they've a free shot at a victory, and I think just with the momentum they have, I think Munster might nick a win against this Edinburgh side.
Brendan, would you see it going that way?
No, I'll go with Edinburgh for this, Donica. And I'd echo Tomás's comments about Ben Healy. He's a really, really good footballer. It's worth going in to watch just the way he moves the team around the park. And the Nick McCarthy situation is very interesting. There was a bit of a let's keep Albie Mathewson in Munster campaign developing there for a couple of weeks, and what a great bloke he was. So Nick McCarthy obviously is the man who's causing the situation where Albie is no longer wanted because he's effectively bed blocking. So Nick McCarthy, who didn't make it in Leinster, really needs to make it in Munster.
And there's young Craig Casey behind him as well. Yeah, I'd agree. It's good to see you know, players in there to bring guys on, but we don't want the pathway stopped for maybe two local guys that could come in there and have opportunities. Okay, moving on to the Connacht versus the Southern Kings game on Saturday at 5:15. Brendan, how do you see this going? The news of Bundiaki signing, could this have a bit of a lift?
Oh, no doubt it would have a lift, but what would have an even bigger lift is the fact that the Connacht front five is back in harness again. Mm-hmm. They were using chewing gum and string to keep them together there for a couple of weeks, but all five first choices are now on the field. Aki back on the field with the deal signed. Adi Alokan back on the wing and playing very well. Caelan Blade playing very, very well. Kings well out of their comfort zone. Bonus point, home win for Connacht.
I'm kind of particularly interested in seeing Conor Fitzgerald's continued development. He was very impressive away from home last week, and you can see it's not critical if you get, I suppose, rejected by a province, obviously let go by Munster last year, and he's proven that he has all the skills and attributes to make it a professional rugby.
And Brendan, then probably the game of the weekend in the Pro 14, Leinster away to Glasgow. You know, this is a healthy rivalry. This is probably the game to watch, isn't it?
It is, and if you look at the Leinster selection, Donica, it's pretty light, but a handful of fellas in there. If you'd be keen to see how Ben Healy goes for Munster tonight at 10, then how Hugo Keenan goes at fullback for Leinster will be every bit as interesting. He really is a very, very good footballer, as is Jimmy O'Brien at 13 and Conor O'Brien at 12. They're different types of players. This is this new young breed coming through Leinster at the moment. Absolutely loads of gas, loads of talent. But they'll be up against it in Glasgow. It's not by any means the strongest selection that Glasgow could have put together, but nevertheless, it's a pretty decent unit. So yeah, that should be well worth watching.
Tomás, Glasgow have been disappointing though this season. We normally see them setting a blaze, sitting in fourth in their conference. Yeah. They'll need this win.
Yeah, they definitely need this win. You know, they've taken a dip over the last kind of year or so. They showed signs, particularly against Exeter in the first half of the game last week. Took it to Exeter away from home and produced some scintillating rugby. But yeah, it looks like they could be back on the upward curve, and a home game against a weakened Leinster side. We all know there's not many weakened Leinster sides anymore, but they'd expect to get a victory and maybe get their campaign back on track.
Okay, lads, I took it for granted as if Connacht would come out on top against Southern Kings. But how do you see this one going, Brendan? Who call it?
I think Leinster might get away with it. The absence of George Horn and Adam Hastings at half back for Glasgow may well be significant. and Leinster are pretty well sorted in that area with Ross Byrne playing well enough. And you feel a little bit for Ross when you think away the way his career was tipping along very nicely and then suddenly plateaued when it became obvious that he wasn't within an ass's roar of going to the World Cup. But he does a very good job for Leinster, and they'll be looking to himself in Gibson Park tomorrow. So yeah, I think Leinster might just get out of there with a win.
Tomás?
Yeah, I think I'll agree. Look, Leinster have become a machine. Winning is a habit, and I think they'll continue that.
Yeah, and lads, three clubmen, the Energy AIL, what's your pick of the weekend? Which game are you looking to head to?
Probably look at UCC, UCD, down to Mardyke, and, you know, I suppose an ex-Munster player at scrum half, John Poland, is going well with them, so that'll probably be my pick of the weekend.
Yeah, for me, I'm heading down to Corcon, Ballinahinch, mainly just to get out of the house, and it's only around the corner. What about you, Brendan?
I'll go down to Castle Avenue tonight. Tarfor playing Lansdowne, and it's interesting, Tarfor in 6th and Lansdowne are in 10th, and no bookie would have given you odds before the Energy League started on the two of them being in those positions. So it's a massive game. Whoever loses this tonight, it's a long, long way back.
It's amazing. You know, you're right, Brendan, at the start you would probably have said that could be a final.
Yeah, you could. And funny, I was chatting to a fella in another club, one of the Limerick clubs, last weekend at the Munster game, and he was saying we're more concerned about the games that Tarfa and Lansdowne win after Christmas. But I feel that if whoever loses this evening, too much damage may well have been done.
Yeah, and Brendan, just before we go, can I ask you about the news on Conor O'Shea, your take on it? A good move?
Yeah, I mean, he's got a stack of experience across a range of areas, and he's a very employable fella. So, I'd say he had his pick of jobs. It wasn't as like he was going to be running around with cap in hand.
Yeah. Okay, guys, thanks very much for joining us. Let's look forward to a great weekend of rugby. We'll chat to you next week.
So that was Dunica and I previewing the Pro 14. Now it's time to talk Conor McGregor, because his comeback has been confirmed after UFC President Dana White said the Dubliner would fight Donald Cerrone on the 18th of January. Sean Sheehan of Severe MMA podcast joins us on the line. Sean, is this the right fight for Conor McGregor?
Yeah, I think it's a good fight. You know, he's fought once in the last 3 years. If he came back now right at the top of the game against a champion or a very, very top contender, I think it'd be a mistake. It's a warm-up fight in a way, but, you know, we look maybe at someone like a Tyson Fury, who had a good bit off and came back and had, you know, a very kind of, you know, borderline ranked fighter, which in boxing is a lot different from MMA. Donald Cerrone is a veteran of the game. He's been around for a long time. He's won 3 fights since Conor McGregor has last fought, and he's fought 2 top contenders as well, lost to them. But Cerrone is a tough fight, but for me, it's the right fight, the right sort of fight that McGregor needs right now.
I know we got into this a little bit when you were on the last time, the focus on his behaviour outside of the ring. But when you put him back in the ring, is he still box office?
He's definitely box office now. Whether he still has the ability or the want or the desire to train and be a great fighter inside the cage, that's a different story. But when you're talking about box office, you're talking about people buying the pay-per-views in America or tuning in here, I think without a shadow of a doubt. You know, it's not hyperbole to say that Conor McGregor is the biggest fighter in the history of MMA, whether you like him or whether you don't like him. That's just the fact of the matter. He is, I think it's 5 of the top 6 biggest-selling pay-per-views in UFC history in the States. So that's, you know, the UFC are desperate to get Conor McGregor back in there. He's big money for them, and he's definitely going to be box office for the UFC.
So, Sean, he says he's in prime physical condition to fight. Where is he and what's he been doing?
Well, he has been training. All the kind of the rumors coming out about him in camp is that he's been training. Now, whether it's in the condition he needs to be to fight a top fighter like Cerrone, someone who's been probably ranked in the top 10, top 15 for the last 10 years or so, that's a different story. Because, you know, we saw him against Khabib Nurmagomedov. It's only 13 months ago, which in the grand scheme of things, I suppose, is not that long. And that's a very difficult fight to look at and see where McGregor actually is because of the style matchup. And Khabib Nurmagomedov is one of the best fighters we've ever seen. But he didn't look good in that fight, and maybe, you know, in most realms of it. So it's interesting to see where he will be. And, you know, it's a thing that we can talk about. Rumours can come out. He can say he's training well. You know, his coaches and everything can say he's doing well. But we won't know until the 18th of January how he's looking. It's the perfect test this Cerrone fight is, really, because if he wins it, you know he's still there. He's still one of the top fighters in the world, and he'll move on to maybe a top five fighter and then maybe a champion after that. But if he loses it, you kind of have to recalibrate your thoughts on Conor McGregor as a fighter, because someone like Cerrone, for me, over down through the years, I think Cerrone has been kind of a perfect matchup for McGregor. He's good on the ground and good everywhere. He's a well-rounded fighter. But McGregor's takedown defense and his ability to strike is just a little bit better than Cowboy Cerrone's, and it kind of always has been. But if it isn't now, that'll show what McGregor is, and it'll show that he isn't the same fighter he used to be. But as I said, we won't know until January 18th whether he's better or worse than Cerrone.
We'll have lots of time for build-up anyway, Sean. Thanks a million for joining us.
Great, no problem at all. Thank you for having me.
So coming up after the news at 7, we have Felix Jones, who spoke to Donegal O'Callaghan. We'll have athletics with Ciara McGeehan, and we'll have the Punters Council. But now it's time to head for the news at 7 after these.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette Skin Guard Sensitive, the first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. So say bye-bye to shave irritation and razor bumps. Gillette, the best a man can get.
So, welcome back to Game On. It is Friday night and there is plenty of rugby on the televisions for anyone who is sitting in and not wanting to watch the toy show, but not us. We'll be watching it, won't we?
The toy show?
Yeah.
I'll be all over the toy show. The Christmas tree went up today.
Donegal will be at the rugby, but I'm sure he'll be watching the toy show after it, no doubt. So we've had a few texts into 51552. Why couldn't Pochettino manage Arsenal, lads? Sure, George Graham managed Spurs, from Jay. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just all very soon. And like with Pochettino, he seemed to actually be in love with the club. There was this kind of, it was almost an unrequited love. He was just obsessed with it. He was so emotional after the Champions League final. It just seemed to mean so much to him. And yeah, maybe down the line, I just can't see it happening right now.
Yeah.
Should we be at Man United anyway?
Well, that's it, yeah. But I'd imagine there's a bit of panic going on. That's the way I would think about it. You know, when you have someone like that kind of in the long grass, you know, with that calibre, you know, Solskjaer, I mean, the lads have spoken about this already, but yeah, I don't know. Like, you got to look at who's out there, who's good. And if you're looking for results, you know, sometimes you got to just get over that and put the best man in.
Well, speaking of that, now we have someone that might know who could be the best man, or at least who could be the most likely man to be the next Arsenal manager. Leon Blanche, how are you?
Good evening, Marie. How are you?
Good. Well, tell us, who could it be?
I don't know. I think, listen, like, a lot of people are saying go and get Brendan Rodgers, but why would Brendan Rodgers leave Leicester? In the top four, plenty of money at the club, he's doing what he's doing. I think they're going to have to look for someone. I've always said maybe someone like a Diego Simeone a few years ago, and the person who would kind of be close to him would be Allegri for me. He hasn't managed since leaving Juventus. The one thing Arsenal have been crying out for a long, long time is a back four. People that can actually defend. Defenders should defend. Arsenal can't defend to save their life at the moment. So for me, if I was an Arsenal fan, I'd be hoping someone of that ilk. They're talking about the Wolves manager, but it's a similar story to Rodgers. Wolves are a very wealthy club. He's doing a great job there. I just don't see either Rodgers or Nuno Espirito, or however you pronounce his name, I don't think they're going to leave the current club that they're in at the minute. Arsenal are a big football club, but they won't be playing Champions League football next year. So that ruled Rodgers out completely. And I think even the Wolves manager is happy. So I think you've got to go for a manager at the moment who wants to prove himself again. And I think in someone like Allegri, if he came in and was given a little bit of time and a bit of funds in terms of improving that back four, I think Arsenal could finish in the top four again in a couple of years' time. But at the minute, Arsenal are way, way off finishing in those Champions League places.
For sure. Now, Liam, we're going to move on to the Punters Council, and I am the punter tonight. I am playing for a challenge for Elaine Tate. It's a story that I heard during the week and it really touched me. I actually don't know Elaine, but her story is that she was undergoing treatment for cancer and she had a rare reaction to the chemo medication and she's paralysed from the waist down. She's three kids. She's confined to a wheelchair. So her club are trying to raise money, her J club, to help adapt her house. So there's a match on tomorrow between Monaghan and Cavan in St Tiernan's Park in Clonus, or on Sunday I should say, and Throne is at 2 p.m. a challenge for Elaine Tate. So you have no Donegal tonight, but far through the odds for me, Leon, we have Alan Cawley's bet. He is gone for a treble, Leicester, Southampton and Chelsea.
Yeah, look, Marie, that Alan's treble in the Premier League is working out at 7-2, which is 3.5-1. We'll double that and we'll go 7-1 for Alan Cawley's treble.
Jane Mangan has chosen Burroughs Saint in the Drinmore Novice Chase on Sunday.
Yeah, look, a very good horse, Marie, trained by Willie Mullins, won the Boyle Sports Irish Grand National last April. He's a 7-1 chance. I'm going to double that again and go 14-1 for Burroughs Saint. And for the Boyle Sports Boost, I was at Newbury today. I'm going to be back there again tomorrow. A horse trained by Colin Tizard will be ridden by Robbie Power. West Approach was a winner last time out at Cheltenham in November. Coming here in the big handicap at 3 o'clock tomorrow, he's around about an 8-1 chance. I'll push him out to 14-1 as well.
Okay, David, I'm not great on what to bet on, so you can pick for me.
I got to go for the Boost.
Okay. Happy days. I'm happy with that.
And I think, Marie, as well, because it's a hard race, Boyle Sports are paying 6 places. I think we should go €50 each way.
Whoa,
at
lovely.
14-1 on West Approach.
I can't ask for much better than that. Leon, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
All the best, Marie. Have a great weekend.
Talk to you soon. You too. Now, as I mentioned a few times already, Dunica is not here tonight, but he has been very busy, which is good to know that we can put him to work even when he's not going to be here. And I'm sure this was a pleasure for him because he got to sit down with a World Cup winning coach, Felix Jones, who's also his friend. So I'm sure he really enjoyed the chats. Let's hear how he got on.
Game on, rugby.
Okay, now to rugby. The 2009 World Cup will be a scarring memory for an awful lot of Irish players, but not for our next guest. We're delighted to be joined by Felix Jones, first Irishman ever to hold the William Webb Ellis. Philo, what was that like?
It was 2019.
You said 2009. Thanks for having my back anyway. 2019, what was that like, Philo?
It was just a crazy couple of weeks and a crazy couple of months. Because I only came in over the last 3 or 4 months with them. I met them out in Japan 2 weeks before the competition started because there was a warm-up game with Japan organized before. So there wasn't a huge amount of time to really think about it. And even now, I'm only back a week or two, having come back. We went to South Africa straight after the tournament to have a little bit of a tour around. So it's only back now and back to normality a bit and spending a bit of time with the family. It's all just been pretty insane, pretty surreal.
So spending time with the family there, obviously from the scenes that we've all seen in South Africa, the effect that that win had on the country, the celebration scenes, and then for you to be, you know, walking around Sandy Cove, walking around Limerick, how's that been?
Yeah, complete opposites, because I think it's hard for, I still don't think I'm comprehending it correctly. There's just so many people. It's almost hard for an Irish person to fathom how many people there are in South Africa. So I think the official population is 57 million. And I mean, there was literally millions when every airport, hotel, every time we got on the bus, there was just thousands and thousands of people the whole time running with the bus in the squares of the city. So we did a load of cities. We did Durban, Port Elizabeth, Cape Town. We did Soweto. We did a load of places that just you wouldn't probably see if you were to go to South Africa just on a holiday or anything like that. So we really got to get into deep South Africa, and it was just something I've never seen before. And the reaction of the people, I mean, again, I've heard people say, what does this actually mean for South Africa? And as I said, I still don't think I fully understand it. It was just to see the reaction of the people. Actually, I think, I'm not sure if this is a fact, but I had heard Supersport in South Africa had actually made the final free to air for the first time. So, I mean, there was probably an extra couple of million people that were watching that game, watching Sia lift the cup. So, that was pretty incredible.
How doesn't that become a massive burden then? You know, like the way that he played in the final, I don't think I've ever seen a team to actually, you know, the way finals are normally lost. But if, like, he went out and won that final. It was amazing to see your best performance was in the final. Just with the weight of expectation as well of a whole country.
It was funny because I know Rassi spoke about it before the final, that what is pressure and what is what is pressure in South Africa, and again, it's very hard for us to relate to it, but he was saying that pressure in South Africa is having a relative or somebody you know murdered. And really, rugby is actually more of a privilege, and it's more, you know, it shouldn't push you down. It should actually rise you up. And yeah, you were right. The players just on the day of the final, it was free. It was just you could just see they're enjoying it. Yeah.
Were you surprised by England? Like for me personally, just I thought they would stand up a little bit more. That they would take you on in what all the rugby people call the arm wrestle. You know, when you look back at the plays, they played a four-man line-out early in the game. They looked to kind of run around you. They never really locked horns for me.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say I was surprised, because obviously a huge amount, Jack would have put in a huge amount of time. The defence coach, Jack Nianabar, you've met him, Donners. I mean, he's just probably the best coach in the world. So he would have put in a huge amount of time to make sure the players were well prepped on what was coming. But it's a funny one, because the turnarounds are so fast in the World Cup, and sometimes you have a 4-day, sometimes you have a 6-day, 7-day, whatever it is. I know we had a 6-day turnaround for the final. And you know how it is. Sometimes emotion in rugby can dip, and then it can be raised up for certain games, and sometimes it could be hard to maintain it for 4 or 5 really tough games. And obviously England, having played New Zealand the week before, having such a phenomenal performance. I mean, it was analysing that game, you're going, where is the weakness here? Where is the weakness? So I think on the day, I think our players, you know, pretty much all had 9 and 10 out of 10s. Maybe not particularly that England played poorly. I think it was just that the big momentum moments in the game went towards South Africa.
I'd agree with that. It's rare you see a team go out and win a final, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it was just, it was a ruthless performance.
Yeah, things just happened to click. And I mean, I think that passage probably before halftime where England were hammering the line, but the lads managed to just keep them out for, I don't know how many phases it went through, but it was a significant momentum swing in the game. And then I think the two tries later in the game from Mpimpi and from Cheslin, I mean, Cheslin's one, it just moments of brilliance from a couple of individuals, and that, you know, put a bit of distance there. Then
I just want to ask if, for you personally, you know, it's always hard to go into a new environment, and I know you knew 3 of the lads in there, but walking in the door, being a little bit shy of maybe the culture and the dressing room, like, you got the call up, is it 2 months kind of before you hit?
It was probably less, probably a month, or if even, I'm trying to think, it was probably even, not even. So there was certainly a degree of familiarity with, obviously, with Rassi, Jacques, and then Alad Walters, who we'd know extremely well, who would have coached us. So, and then having obviously worked with them and Jerry, obviously, at the time in Munster, you know, there was a good degree of familiarity there. And we knew what was expected of each other and what they're asking to deliver. And then there wasn't any time, Donners, to really kind of go, oh God, you just had to do it, because there was no time. You were in. I mean, I arrived probably the next day or 2 days later. You're presenting on Japan and getting ready for a test match. So, and then after that, the games came thick and fast. So next game is New Zealand. Next game, I think we had a 4 or 6 day turnaround, and then again. So just you don't really have that much time.
That would be an incredible task for all the top coaches to go in, but you're a young coach, Philo, and going in to that type of environment, like, how sure in your rugby, how sure in your own self-ability do you have to be to walk in there and to present to guys that you know of them from, you know, swatting and doing the homework, you know, they're the best in the world, but your ability to be at the level, I just take, for example, we know in Irish culture you can be tough on some guys. You didn't know any of that walking into that room.
No, I didn't. So again, I would have been guided massively by the coaches that were there. And it's not like I was going in having not seen these guys or spoken to these guys over the last 3 years. You know, even after Rassi and Jacques and Alad left, I'd have been in contact with them a good bit, just because they're good guys. And then if you ever need some rugby, if you want to chat rugby with them, they're more than happy to do it. So, you know, I would have had a good idea on you know, the key drivers in the team and who are the guys responsible for certain areas that you really need to tap into. So yeah, I think, look, the way I look at it is just if you can be content in yourself that you've worked as hard as you can and that you've really done your analysis or your coaching or your presentation to the best of your ability. And then if it doesn't work after that, then you can at least say, okay, all right, it wasn't good enough. That's that, you can be content with that. But so as long as I knew in my own mind that we were everyone was giving their best effort across all departments, myself included, then I could be content.
That's your point of difference from playing with you, though, your ability to make sure you leave everything out there. And I know this might sound like a sad thing to say, but I know when you had to hang up your boots, I was nearly glad to hear the news, because I was always worried when you went out, because you knew no other way. You knew that every time you went on the pitch, you were going to empty yourself. And as a teammate, sometimes that was quite worrying, because we wanted the best for your safety. You know, just on that, for you, the ability to constantly dig deep and give everything to a cause. And
I think that's a lot of that is determined by the people that you surround yourself with, or the people that have had influences on you as you go. So when I first moved down to Munster, I immediately just recognized say the group, yourself, Fla, Paulie, Dowling, all of us, not necessarily the most talented players, but I could see the success that came with just working hard, and I just thought that would be a good thing to try and attach yourself to and try and follow that route. So I think as much of it, again, then you look at the coaches that I've been lucky enough to learn off. I mean, you look at Rassi, you look at Jacques, you look at Joe. All of them are just guys that are almost, you know, almost obsessed, but it's not just a 9-to-5. It's something that you're constantly wanting to get better at. So I think as it's as much about the guys that you surround yourself with, that you try to learn off, that you follow suit a little bit.
You have those values and traits, and does that make international coaching appealing to you, where it could be in blocks, so you go for, say, a championships, a Six Nations? Because, you know, just from personally knowing you, I know you can't switch off and you're always on. Would that be something that would give you a bit of breathing space in between to get the balance right with family and friends and everything that's important outside of rugby?
I don't know, Dunnes, is my honest answer, because I haven't fully experienced it, you know, to do a full season at that level. And I don't know what my next step is going to be. But for sure, there's definitely a need to manage yourself and not allow yourself to burn out or to go over. But it's a funny thing, because when you first get into coaching, there's no one that hands you a coaching manual and says that this is exactly how you do it, this is how you should structure a week, this is how you do it. You kind of have to almost sometimes make the mistakes and know when too much is too much and when too little is too little to actually figure it out. And I'm still figuring it out. So I don't know if it would be. I'm sure the more you go up the levels, the pressures become different. So I don't actually know, but maybe I'll find out at some stage in the future.
And it's not from the lack of going around to different environments. You've been to New Zealand, you've been to England, worked a bit with Quinns and Northampton, I think it was, seen different environments. It's great to be in that position now, Felix, where you can step back and probably have a look, because the approaches are coming.
Yeah, and the coaching world are small donors, and generally speaking, like most clubs and most rugby coaches, because of the values of the game, they are happy to share and to help. And like I said, the coaching world is quite small. So I've been over to a number of places in England, even Gerv and there's another Irish guy, Dan Tobin, over in Gloucester with Ackerman, and then Pat Lamb is over in Bristol. So they've also been good to me over the last couple of months, opening the doors and allowing people to come in and just get a look at what they're doing. So I think that's important, because probably one of the the key things I've realized is that there's 10 different ways of doing things or more. You can do it whatever way you want. And all of them are right in different departments, but you just have to make sure that you can get 15 or 30 or your squad of 40 people all going in that one direction and buying into it. And that actually appears to be the real skill of it, is actually getting people all on the same line. So yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways of doing things, and the more you can open your mind, whether it's in New Zealand, South Africa, England, Ireland, I mean, you know, there's France, there's so many great teams and great coaches out there.
Well, one that certainly does that is Razzie, and no better person to speak to him, but there was an incredible moment probably for all the Munster people when they saw the 4 East thing and stand up and fight on the bus. And what was beautiful about that, Felix, was it's no but staged. It was something that looked like he wanted to do. Yeah. I know from your time at Munster, but just that whole group, you know, that moment and the place Munster holds for the four of you.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, we're all unbelievably fond of the place. I know Rassi and Jacques, you know, I mean, just being with them recently, they're just constantly talking about it, asking how everyone is and asking, you know, how's this player doing? How's this guy, you know, or anyone, even board member, you know, how's that person doing? And then asking about guys in the area, how's the guy in that pub? How's he getting on? And I mean, and then for myself and Alad, or myself anyway, I absolutely love the place. I just, it's given me everything, you know. I fell in love with it from the moment I walked in the cafeteria, actually just beside UL. I remember coming down to visit before I actually joined the club, and I just thought, this is it. This is the place for me. Everything about the club just spoke to what I believed in. So, I don't know, that moment on the bus, it was just, yeah, we all happened to just be sitting together, and you know, the cup is going around, and we all had the cup, and such, you know, this is actually, you know, one of the, it was just the four of us kind of in a conversation together, and when the cup came together, so it just seemed to fit right, you know.
Because it's hard, I went through it myself with Munster, and you were there at the time. I had a year to run on my contract, and I knew if I hung around, I'd become resentful, I'd become bitter, I wouldn't kind of hold the Munster values like they needed to be. And you had that as well in ways, you know, you had a contract, and just, you know, coming away from Munster, is there a place still there in time, do you think, for you? Is it a role you would like to see yourself back in the future?
I don't know, Dunners. I don't know. All I can say is that it's somewhere that I really hold dear, and just, you know, I said before I left, I'll always be a Munster supporter, there's no question, and I want to see them down the line winning European Cups and being consistently at the top table. I honestly don't know what the future holds for me, and I've kind of promised Leanne and the lads that I wouldn't engage in too much stuff. I said, let's get to Christmas and then we'll start thinking about what's next, but I don't know.
Felix, thanks so much for joining us on Game On. We wish you the best of luck, but more importantly, I hope you get to enjoy that time up to Christmas with your family. I know you'll empty your bag and whatever you go on to do next, and you'll be highly successful. But thanks so much, brother.
Cheers, Dennis. Thanks, man.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. I'm delighted to say that we have Irish international athlete Ciara Mageen on the line, fresh from picking up Athletics Ireland Athlete of the Year yesterday. Ciara, thank you for joining us. How are you feeling today?
Thanks for having me on. I'm delighted. Yeah, a little bit tired. It was a busy day yesterday, but over the moon. I definitely didn't expect to get that award. So it's
really
a lovely little...
You didn't expect it after the year you've had?
No, well, look, Brendan did fantastic out at World Champs as well, and I'm well aware that we have some fantastic athletes at the minute in Irish athletics, so it's a huge honour to pick up that award.
Does it make you think back over the last couple of months? Because I know your season isn't quite finished yet, or your year isn't quite finished yet, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But obviously you've had a long year, going back to the indoors where you picked up the bronze medal, and then you had Doha, and then finally yesterday getting that Athlete of the Year award. Does it make you bring you back to the start of the year and how things kind of flowed from there?
Oh, it kind of does, yeah. It's, I suppose, for me as a track athlete, ultimately, I'm definitely better on the track than over the cross. It nearly feels like the 2019 season ends at the end of the track year, and then the 2020 season starts at cross country. So so it's really nice little kind of cherry on the top of a fantastic year to be given an award, remembering all of the fantastic runs throughout 2019. So it's a lovely way, and I suppose it does make you reflect a little, because you can just be a whirlwind and just fly into the next racing season. So for me, track season was parked. I had a little bit of a break at home, and then it's straight back into training for the cross. So it is nice to slow down a little, to be back among all the people from Irish Athletics, and yeah, have a nice meal and celebrate a nice year.
Yeah, well, you are only back for the day, and obviously you had to get back to work. But you were joined on the stage yesterday by Sonia O'Sullivan, who obviously was inducted into the Athletics Ireland Hall of Fame. You know, she is someone that obviously, in the 1500 context, she has the national record at 3:58. You're closing in on that.
Yeah, I'm getting slowly closer. Sonia has some fantastic records that I don't think I will get as close to, but her 1500 record is very good, and it's something that I'm slowly starting to realise that it is within my grasp. I always believed I was capable of going and trying to run a new Irish record over the 15. But this past season has shown me that it's a very tangible thing. And if I was in the right race in 2019, I think I maybe could have done it. I'm looking forward to 2020 and what's to come. But yeah, eyeing up Sonia's records, it's fantastic to have shared the stage with her yesterday. It's such a huge honour, and I feel truly privileged that I was able to share that, and the fact that I'm following in Sonia's footsteps, because she has some very big boots to try to fill.
Spikes, very big spikes.
Spikes, exactly.
Do you remember much of her career growing up?
So I've been asked a lot about Sonia over the past few weeks, because obviously it was her birthday yesterday as well, and it was nice to be able to celebrate that too. But I actually grew up in a GAA household and wouldn't have known a whole lot about athletics as I was coming up through my young life. And I probably became much more aware of Sonia whenever I started doing athletics itself in my secondary school years. So I'm very envious of people that have that memory of watching Sonia in Sydney and being like, oh my goodness, because I was aware of who she was and I knew the name, but I didn't have that real tangible kind of knowledge of athletics and that wow factor. But believe me, as I've progressed through my career as an athlete, the more I get closer to Sonia's kind of times and realise what she accomplished, the more in awe I am of her. So it's not really something that as a youngster I was like, oh my goodness, I looked and I thought, wow, I want to do that. But now I'm probably even more in awe of Sonia, and I'm very grateful for that. Like I enjoy looking over her races and seeing how she raced, and even learning more about her career as an athlete. She came through some pretty rough times. She had ups and downs. And yeah, if anybody's looking for a role model, they don't have to look too far.
Yeah, well said. And obviously you are following in her footsteps, kind of getting into the cross-country side of things as well. And like I said, your year isn't over. You have the European Cross coming up next week. How did that come about? Obviously, off the back of Doha, a bit of a break. Was it always on the plan for this year, or the start of, as you said, your 2020 season?
Yeah, whenever I walked off the track in Doha, I was 100% set for Eurocross. And Teresa McDade is often the lady who's at Eurocross with us. And I said to Teresa, yeah, I'll be there. I'll be racing cross. But as I had my break, I caught a bit of a head cold and had more time off than I had planned. So myself and Steve were like, look, we might not go ahead with the plans to race cross country. The big aim is Tokyo 2020, and obviously it's nice to race the cross, but I didn't want to put myself under an awful lot of pressure to get fit very quickly. And then as it transpired, I was doing a few sessions, and actually specifically after one hill session that I did with Steve, I struck up a conversation that I was chatting to Michelle Finn, and she was trying to convince me to race the cross. So that conversation kind of sparked us both to be like, well, actually, you are training well, and maybe we could consider it, because I've always enjoyed racing cross country. It's actually where I cut my teeth as a youngster and began athletics. And as much as I'm not the world beater over cross, I'm much better on the track. I think it serves a very good purpose for me over the winter. So, and I think I can be a valuable member of the Irish team on the cross country course as well. So it is often a baptism of fire for me getting back and fit and then going racing Eurocross. It's definitely over distance. with 8K over the cross, but I'm looking forward to it. And it's the type of thing, I'm not as fit as I was come the end of the track season, and nobody could expect me to be, but I know that I can go out and have a good, very good representation of myself there, and my aim's to finish as high up as a senior cross athlete as I can.
Well, it's nothing new to you, because like last year you did win the national title. You obviously went over to Tilburg at the Europeans as well. That wasn't a great day for you, as you said yourself. So you didn't compete in last week's national championships. Any particular reason for that?
To be honest, it's that I just feel I need that little bit more training in the legs. So since Doha, I had had 2 weeks off running. And I actually began running after 3 days because I was so pumped and ready to get ready for the cross-country season. So I had 3 days off and started running. And
3 days?
Was feeling really good. Yeah, 3 days after Doha, no running. And then I got easing back into it. And unfortunately, I feel like, as I know I'm not old by any stretch of the imagination, I'm 27, but I feel old compared to some of the new youngsters coming through, and I need to keep moving. Otherwise, if I took 2 weeks solid off, I don't think I'd run another step in my life. So I had to keep the body ticking over. But unfortunately, then after a couple of days of running, I caught a bit of a head cold, and that knocked me out for 5, 6, 7 days of absolutely zero running, and that just sent me back that little bit. So I feel that I was trying to make up a little bit of ground, and just having a good hard training session last week put me into probably a better position to be able to race well at Eurocross than it would have done so if I flew over home and raced the trials. I'm actually going to step out and race a 5K over here tomorrow in Manchester to blow the cobwebs and to show form. And
is that on the road or the
back to? Yeah, it's actually it'll be on the road. It's I was only looking at the course today. It's in like a bit of a K loop that's a cycle track.
Okay.
So I'm excited. It's quite interesting. Just over a K per lap, and I'm hoping to go out and have a good fast race and really just get the body ready, because 8K cross will be tough, and I want to be as ready as I can be for it.
And I suppose, taking a step back, okay, like I did interview you in, I've interviewed you a couple of times over the years now. And in Doha, I was very well prepared. I had my toilet paper, I had the bucket, I had a cordon area around you so nobody would get hit with spray, but you didn't even get sick. You were so confident that you came off the track. And it struck me that you were an athlete that was very comfortable in that situation, in that environment. And, you know, can you put it down to one thing, two things? What has changed over the last maybe year and a half?
Well, I did get sick, Dave, unfortunately, but I kept it for before I met you. I snuck off beforehand. You always get such grief for interviewing me while I'm throwing up, and I'm like, it's not his fault. He's always so prepared. But I do think there was a difference in me, and I think everybody saw it whenever I was competing out in Doha. And, what could I say is the tangible thing that's changed? I'm not 100% sure. I've had a good 2 years of consistent training with Steve over here in Team MB Manchester, and that's given me confidence. So knowing that it's been consistent, I've progressively gotten stronger season on season, year on year, gives you that little bit of confidence stepping out. But I think the main thing is really my mindset towards racing, and I've worked super hard over the past 2 years to really improve how I feel towards racing and even how I feel towards the sport, to be honest. In the past, and whenever I came to Steve, I probably would have said I hated athletics, and I did it because I was good at it. And that's not a good place for anybody to be. It's something that I do because I do love it, but I just had fallen out of love with the sport, and I actually saw it as a burden and pressure as opposed to a privilege and an honour to step out. And maybe that came off the back of some bad performances and some tough times, but I've really kind of matured with my mindset towards the sport, and I realise, and I remind myself, because it is hard, you fall back into old habits, but whenever I set foot on the line, and it was the same for European indoors, and now it's the same for the outdoors whenever I raced in the summer, that whenever the announcer says on your marks, that's whenever your tummy kind of like drops a bit and you're feeling very nervous. I remind myself, like, I want to be here. This is a privilege. It's an honour. Go give your best. Race your heart out. And I know if I walk off the track having given the best that I could possibly give, then I can't ask for anything more. So I think realising that, as much as it seems like a simple message, and I've been told it before, I've fully adopted it, and I believe it myself, and having the confidence, like I discussed with Steve very clearly what my aims and goals are, and we're very conscious not to set limits on myself. He would never come and tell me you're not capable of doing X, Y, and Z, but he does give me realistic goals, and he's like, okay, this is what I feel that we can do. And for example, going into that final, we discussed what the scenarios might be, and he said Sifan Hassan might take it from the gun and run a time that you can't run, Kira, so you need to be ready for that. Yeah. So I wrote down all my scenarios. Some of it was a tactical race, some of it was slow, some of it was steady. And one of them was the pace goes out blistering and you're just caught and I'm not going to be able to compete with 351. And unfortunately, I'm not able to compete with 355 and 358 just yet. So for me to keep my head in that final was big for me. Some people might think of 10th in the race. It looks. I feel like coming 10th in the girls round 351, that's a huge, huge gap back to me. But for me, I kept my head and stayed focused in the race. I raced ultimately a time trial on my own.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that. And now I know that that's what I can do and I can go even faster. So I'd say, yeah, that tangible difference is consistency in training, but it's,
and confidence.
It's enjoying the sport and confidence, in myself and my abilities.
And look, you know, what a season before an Olympic Games. What a winter to go into with that behind you. And obviously, you know, with the Eurocross coming up and then obviously into 2020, you know, it's you speak so honestly, and I've got to be honest to myself. It's inspirational. Maybe I'll get out tomorrow and do a 5K. You've given me a good pump to go and do it. But, you know, looking ahead, we just want to wish you all the best. Godspeed next week. And we will be doing the races live from Lisbon as well on RT2. So we're all going to be rooting for you. And best wishes and enjoy your weekend.
Thanks a million, Dave. And I'll have to get a 5K with you sometime.
Oh, no. I'll let you go ahead of me. You're grand.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the support.
Game on Friday Night Racing.
Okay, Jane Mangan tells us there's a brilliant weekend of racing ahead, so I'm so excited about it. Jane, how are you?
I'm good, Danica, and I know you're chomping at the bit because we have a couple of grade ones and a very big handicap chase this weekend.
Very good. Well, kick us off with the Ladbrokes Trophy at Newbury.
Yeah, I suppose known to everybody by its old name, the Hennessy, and it's often a race that just throws up a Gold Cup standard type horse. It's a handicap in the name and it's run over 3.25 miles. So as you can imagine, it's just such a dour test of the horse. But this year, there's a real interest in it this year. We have three Irish runners, two of them for Willie Mullins, Cabaret Queen and York Hill. And Gordon Elliott sends over the Galway Plate winner, Bo Rees, first run after a wind-up. But what's very interesting about this is Cabaret Queen was purchased only last May for £13,000 from the Dan Skelton Yard, moved by Jack Cantillan and syndicated to Willie Mullins. And a big bunch of owners were in Limerick to see her dot up in the Munster National at Limerick. Subsequently, she's been hit hard by the handicapper, but that means she gets into a race of this stature. And now, having run and won the €59,000 handicap at Limerick, she's running here in the Ladbrokes Trophy for six-figure sums. So that would be a fairy tale were that to come off. And at the moment, I think she's trading as second favourite behind OK Corral. OK Corral, classy novice chaser last year, backed by Manny for the National Hunt Chase over 4 miles at the festival at Cheltenham. But ultimately, he just didn't show up. There was a lot of excuses on the day, but ultimately, the true OK Corral didn't run his race. He's a very lightly raced horse. He's only had the 10 starts. He's won 5 of them. And this is his handicap debut. So I think he could be, I can see why he's favoured, because he could potentially be an unknown quantity. Very hard for the handicapper to assess, and could still be ahead of his mark of 151. That said, in a handicap first time, this is a big competitive field. He might lack experience, but I can totally see why people have put him up as favourite, because he's the potential horse. Personally, I'd be looking for horses at bigger prices in a race like this. A lot of bookmakers will pay the first six and maybe more home in this race. I do think York Hill is the best horse in the race, but I don't think he's a reliable candidate anymore. Big ride for Brian Hayes to get. He's a former JLT winner. Ruby won at the festival on him twice. But he's an enigmatic character and one that I really couldn't trust. So I think Colin Tizard holds a lot of aces here. He's got three really good chances. Elegant Escape at top weight, Harry Cobden on board. He's going to do well to defy the weight, but he's got really good stamina in the book. Robin's Firth at bigger prices, I like him. Sean Bowen is on him. We haven't seen him since February when he won a 3.5 mile Haydock handicap chase. Got a £5 penalty for that, but still off 153 could be one at a bigger price. And of course, the man in form, Robbie Power, rides for Colin Tizard as well on West Approach, a horse he won at Cheltenham over 3 1/4 miles only 2 weeks ago. He's a horse that needs to be delivered very late, but he runs under a £4 mandatory penalty. The handicapper hasn't been able to give him the full wallop that he wants. And if he's on a going day, West Approach is definitely one to be keeping an eye on late on.
Jane, the Fighting Fifth hurdle at Newcastle, will all eyes be on Bouvadair as he bids to win it for the third consecutive year for Barry Geraghty, Nicky Henderson and JP McManus?
Yeah, you're dead right. This is all about, is the Bouvadair going to be a big champion hurdle contender this year? We've already seen Classical Dream fluff his lines, and I think this is the ideal start again. He's won it the last 2 years, as you say, going for the hat-trick, and it's a race that's really tailor-made for him. Silver Streak ran third in the champion hurdle behind Esper de Lynn last March, but that was when Bouvadair came down at the second or third hurdle, and really that race fell apart. And Bouvadair really showed himself at Punchestown on his last start last season when he beat Super Sunday comfortably, which he should be doing if he is of champion hurdle standard, which we know he is. He should be beating Super Sunday as he did. He's by far the highest rated horse in the race, 167. There's only the 5 runners. I think Barry Geraghty will keep it nice and simple. I'd be very disappointed if Bouvadair had to break a sweat, to be honest.
Jane, let's go to Ferry House. It hosts 3 grade ones on Sunday. Let's start with the Hatton's Grace Hurdle. I'm going to have to ask you, Apples Jade.
Oh, here we go, Jane.
Will she return to form?
Oh, I'm really hoping she will, Marie. I can't tell you that she will. I was blown away by... I've always been a big fan. Always been a big fan. This mare, she's still a relatively young mare, but she's been on the go since a 3-year-old, since she started in France. She's 10 grade ones to her name. Everybody knows she's the best horse lining up in the race, but is she as good as she was last year? If she was the same mare that lined up 12 months ago when she pulverised Super Sunday and more, I think Ruby Road Limonee that day, she absolutely routed him. She went from the front with Wicklow Brave. Wicklow Brave, a Group 1 winner on the flat, and with 4 or 5 furlongs to go, he couldn't lie up with her. That was, for me, the performance of her career. And has she backed that up since? I don't think so. I think that has been the highlight of her year last season, and it went downhill after Christmas. And I was hoping that she would do, as she regularly does, come back to form in the autumn. But it was a really lackluster display at Navan last time. Bacardi's, who beat her, is reopposing, and she's going to have to really bounce back to herself. On official ratings, Honeysuckle is £12 to find with Apples Jade, but I think that's probably because she's never taken on this calibre of horse. There's less question marks about her. We know that she's very, very solid, and her form is unwavering. She's been unbeaten. But if she was to put in a performance where she could beat Bacardi's, who's 157, Apples Jade, who's 162, Penhill is 160, Honeysuckle would just shoot to the top of the ratings. This is a really intriguing race because you have Bacardi's, who's been there and done it, Apples Jade, been there and done it, Penhill, been there and done it. Honeysuckle is the young pretender.
Jane, is it an important race for Apples Jade? You know the way you're speaking, like, all heart, but that gets questioned at a point. Is it fair to put her out there and nearly expose her like that?
Yeah, I suppose until you... She's obviously pleasing them at home because they wouldn't... there's no point in running a race if you're not going to be competitive. So she's obviously pleasing them at home, but it's until you step into grade one level, and she's that kind of mare where every race she runs is at grade one level because that's how good she is. There's no point in Apples Jade lining up in a handicap because off 162, what is she going to do? I would hate to see her disgrace herself. I don't think anybody would want to see her campaigned unless she is competitive every time. The 6 runners in here, it'll be interesting. Will she go forward? She does jump a little bit out to her right, so Fairy House suits her. There's a lot of things that Jack Kennedy's back on board, Robbie Power rode her Navan. So it'll be interesting just even what Jack will say, because he knows her better than anyone. And if he thinks that it's not the same mare, then maybe they have a decision to make. But I'd love, even if she ran a solid in the first 3, that's still an improvement on what we saw in Navan, and then they'd have something to build on working towards Christmas. But this is a very good renewal of the Hatton's grace. It's a pity Benny DeJeu of Willie Mullins' wasn't declared, but at the same time, can't rule out Bicardi's on his season reappearance at Navan. It was a very good run, and he's a top flight performer over hurdles. He just didn't take chasing last year, hence his form figures aren't all that attractive.
The Drinmore Novices chase, James, it looks like it could be a thriller. Who are the main contenders here?
Well, I think this is a very good race. Six runners, but last year we didn't have a big field, and we had Delta Work, who beat Larishberg, Cadmian, Jets and Discorama. That was such a good renewal last year, and it's something similar this year, to be honest, Marie. We have, obviously, Sam Crow is the horse that's been talked about probably more than any novice of his kind. When he won the Ballymore last, as a novice hurdler two seasons ago, you know, the sky was the limit, and they campaigned him as a champion hurdle horse last year. It just didn't work out, but we always knew he was going to be a chaser. He's a former point-to-point winner, and this is only his second start over fences in public. He's going to go off. He's likely favourite. He's going to probably be the one that people will be watching closely. But for me, Burrow Saint, a former last season's Irish Grand National winner for Willie Mullins. Now, yes, he likes a bit further than 2.5 miles, I think, but he's an ample amount of experience. Willie Mullins has pitched him in here. If it was a day later, so if it was on Monday, if this race was run on Monday, this horse wouldn't even qualify because he wouldn't be actually a novice on Monday. This is his last day as a novice, and this is an opportunity that he won't get again. Himself and Sam Crow, if they were meeting, Sam Crow has a rating of 160 over hurdles. Now, this is very, this is just fairy tale stuff if you were taking it literally. Burrow Saint is 156 over fences, and Sam Crow is 160 over hurdles. So they're quite evenly matched. It's difficult to translate hurdles form and chase form, but for me, Burrow Saint has experienced that the rest of the opposition don't. Fakhar Duderi is definitely worth mentioning as well. He beat Mellon quite comfortably by 3 lengths at Navan on his chase debut. He's only a 4-year-old, so he's getting a weight allowance against the likes of Burrow Saint. He's getting £8 of a weight allowance for just being a 4-year-old. And he was second in a brace of Grade 1's novice hurdlers last season. So he's just off top quality as a novice hurdler as well. So this is a very, very intriguing race.
Jane, in the Royal Bond Hurdle, Envoy Allen is probably the most exciting novice hurdler in training. How good is he?
That is the question that hopefully will be answered this weekend. This is a faultless horse. He's big. He's physically imposing. He's won a point to point. He's everything that would suggest Gold Cup horse. He had then, thus, if you go into with that frame of mind, how did he win 4 bumpers last year, including what he did at Cheltenham? He beat Blue Sari, who's Frank the Farm. He beat Time Hill, who won a Grade 2 at Cheltenham last time. And he beat Abracadabras, who reopposes and won the For Auction last time. That form is just rock solid. He came out on his hurdles debut at Down Royal last month. He beat Front View, who subsequently franked the farm in Cork, but he beat him in a common canter. I don't know how good this horse is. I don't know, does anybody know how good this horse is? Because we've never really, like, the most pressure he came under was on good ground at Leopardstown last February. And to be honest, good ground isn't his, it wouldn't be his forte. I can't wait to see him over fences, but this guy could be next level.
Jane, we all know the highlight of the weekend is the toy show tonight, but what are you looking forward to racing-wise?
Like I said, I'm really looking forward to seeing Envoy Allen. I'm really looking forward to seeing Honeysuckle, but a big result for me would be Apple's Jade returning to form. That might be wishful thinking, but we have 37 Grade 1s run in the National Hunt Sphere every year in Ireland. We have 3 of them in Fairy House on Saturday. And to be honest, They're three corkers. They're absolutely brilliant races. There's a lot of depth. There's no one horse that you could say is definitely going to win any single one of these races.
And Jane, you're in Fairy House on Sunday with RTE. Who's with you?
Myself and Hugh and the team are going to try and break down a few winners for you guys. And we'll hopefully have a nice day for it. Look, Fairy House is one of the best tracks in the country. It's one of the fairest tracks in the country. And as regards jumping, it doesn't get any better. So we were there last year when we saw Apple's Jade pulverise the opposition. We were there the same day Delta Work and Larishburg went hammer and tongs down to the last. So if we can get a reproduction of anything like that, because they really lit up the National Hunt season last year. And if something similar comes along on Sunday, we'd be very lucky.
Could you bump into Ruby?
Always, always. That man is never at home. He's always out and about.
He certainly is. Jane, have a great weekend. We look forward to seeing you on Sunday. Thanks for joining us on Game On.
Thanks guys. Pleasure.
Game On. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.